You're listening to a podcast of The View, brought to you by the Church of the Larger Fellowship. To find other episodes of The View and to subscribe to this podcast, visit questformeaning.org/VUU.
Good morning and welcome to The View. I am Joanna Fontaine Crawford and I am here in Austin, Texas. Joining us today is Katia Hansen, President and CEO of UU Rise, the UU Refugee and Immigrant Services and Education. Katia, please tell us a little bit about that, and also how long has that, I'm not that familiar with it, how long has that existed?
Well, good morning, and I'm coming to you from San Diego County, where we are a little unseasonably cold, so I'm a little jealous of Buffalo being overly warm. It's only about 45 degrees this morning, which is chilly for here.
Well, that's a new one.
It's not terrible, but, you know, I grew up in the upper Midwest, so I'm used to it. It's just, you know, our homes are out here aren't built with the same type of insulation or, you know, with thermostats and things like this. So it's a little chilly. So URISE was founded in 2007, and we have been around since that time. From 2007 until 2010, we were actually an all-volunteer organization. I was a founding member of the board of directors. Daniel Straka was the founding president and brought us all together. It was his vision and in honor of his late wife, Barb, that he moved forward in this. He had been doing immigration and refugee resettlement for a couple of decades prior and always had this idea of wanting to start a UU organization to do that because there are a lot of UUs who have interest in working on immigration and working with refugees, but they have historically had to do them through other denominations and through other nonprofits. So through Catholic Charities or Lutheran Social Services or Jewish Family Service, any of those. And we know that UU families and UU individuals have often been a lot of help and very involved with that. And so his goal was to start a UU organization that would provide a place for UUs to be involved and actually, you know, share our name and show that we are walking our walk and talking our talk. So we started in 2007 and we have been around since that time. We do direct practice immigration services in Southern California, but across the United States as well, because, of course, immigration is federal law, so it doesn't matter what state we're in or what state we are working with someone in. And we
my county legislature can't ban Syrian refugees?
They can't. Well, why shouldn't say that? We know that they can do anything. Whether or not it actually impacts whether or not there's refugees resettled there doesn't.
They're going to pass a law.
They're gonna pass a law, and they may be very strident and very assertive in passing that law. It's they just don't have the oomph to make it happen because they, of course, are superseded by the federal law. So
obviously, this is something that I would say many UUs have been interested in the last few years, but right now, because it has changed from thinking of refugees and immigrants as, I think before this, kind of our whole focus was on Mexico and Latin American countries, and now with Syria, we're you know, kind of looking at things in a different way. How do you think that has affected some of the thought around this?
Well, I think it's been interesting to kind of watch the rhetoric shift. Because for the longest time, what we heard was illegal immigration, illegal immigration, with people thinking that meant something and what we keep saying is not only is it inappropriate and just rude to use that terminology, it also doesn't mean anything. It doesn't give you an indication of what someone's status is, whereas when we talk about someone being undocumented, it does. But to go back to that original question, the rhetoric has shifted from everyone's fear being around people coming into the United States undocumented or remaining in the United States undocumented, and they've previously said, oh, we don't mind, you know, people seeking asylum or people who are refugees going through the correct process. We just want people to go through the right process. And now that's being challenged because, of course, we have all of these refugees who are going through the process, and suddenly people are losing their mind again and saying, no, 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 they could be the terrorists. And, you know, we're afraid of these refugees. We're afraid of these people seeking asylum. And suddenly we've gone to wanting no one.
I was very interested to read. Okay, so Angela Merkel just got, you know, chosen as Time's Person of the Year. Mm-hmm. And apparently one of the things that she has done is she has opened their borders to, I think I read, to 1 million Syrian refugees. Does that give us any sort of information or things that we can learn from here?
You know, one of the things that's really hard about looking at European refugee resettlement and the United States refugee resettlement is our systems are entirely different. You made a comment about Syrian refugees being resettled in Texas. And what a lot of people don't know is that the people who are currently being resettled right now have been in the resettlement process for at least 2 years. So The people who are going to Germany are people who are currently fleeing across borders. The people who are coming to the United States have been in, you know, a refugee camp, a displaced persons camp, and they've gone through the process of being handpicked by the UN, labeled as refugee, being handpicked by the US from those, from that pool, and going through an extensive background check. Interviews, you know, with the Department of Justice, with Department of Homeland Security, with the FBI, and all of that before they even come to the United States. I'm hopeful that the fact that Germany and France have continued to be so open in their acceptance of refugees that maybe some of our lawmakers will be shamed into or inspired into being more open and thinking more from their heart and less from their fear.
I think one of the things that I've noticed about what's happening in Europe and when we've taken in refugees, because don't forget there's a lot of people from Somalia here and Sudan, right. And Seattle has a huge population of folks from both those countries and Eritrea. And what has been so impressive is how my son's was in the public school system here, is in the public school system, and there's been a concerted effort to give services to folks who are here who don't know the language. So in the Seattle public school system, you could pick from maybe 12 languages, including languages from countries in East Africa and all parts of Africa. So to me, what's happened in Europe in some cases and in France also is when refugees, first of all, they're living in camps, and then they seem to be ghettoized in their countries where, knock wood, but for the most part, I don't think quite the same thing is happening here, which if there was some nuance to the conversation nationally, we could say we already are doing it differently here and saying to people, you are accepted here. We are a nation of immigrants. I'm an immigrant. I came here when I was a toddler. I was born in Egypt. And I'll tell you, I hold on to my U.S. Citizenship papers very tightly, even though I've been here forever and my kids are here, my husband's. I'm Manhattan born, but there's still a little bit of, you know, a little bit of anxiety in me. I'm like, I have a Muslim name. But anyway, so I think that's the difference between Europe and the United States and how we've accepted or at least tried working on the continual process in integrating immigrants.
One thing that this is not immigrants. Let me be clear that I'm not saying that, but an interesting little statistic that I saw with the Hurricane Katrina survivors was that so when they came to Houston, there were, I think the statistics were, there were 250,000 people from New Orleans and that area that came to Houston. 44,000 of them were Vietnamese, and because there's a high Vietnamese population in New Orleans. And the one of the big differences is that all of that 44,000 were absorbed into the Vietnamese community, into the families that were all there. They weren't, you know, they didn't go to any of the shelters or anything. I'm curious how this plays out on a national scale, especially like with Syrian refugees. Bob just mentioned, you know, a refugee that he knows that is coming over is going to Buffalo because he has a cousin there. You know, is that dynamic happening on a big scale? And if not, what are the things that you churches can do? You know, can we step into that gap and be that family?
So when it comes to resettlement, one of the major factors that they look at is there a support system for, you know, this particular family, this particular group of people? One of the things that resettlement has done, I think, fairly well is creating groups of settlement. So you don't have, you know, just one family who ends up in, you know, Phoenix and one family who ends up in Tucson, and, you know, they do a good job of kind of grouping people so that there are some built-in supports. And part of that is around refugee resettlement agencies, but certainly a role of that is what is the cultural support there, what's the familial support. San Diego is a large refugee resettlement area. Minneapolis is a large refugee resettlement area. Lincoln, Nebraska. Seattle, I know you have a large population up there. Minneapolis, yeah. Nebraska has been a really good resettlement area. Actually, a lot in the Midwest has, a lot of cities in the Midwest have been good resettlement areas because of the openness of the community to rise up and you know, welcome the stranger and to say, you know.
Can I jump in and ask a question about the technical elements of this? Because my friend from Afghanistan, once he got his visa, he has to give it, you know, photocopy it and send it to a resettlement agency that's run by the State Department. Am I understanding this correctly? And then they make it happen. They actually issued the tickets and get him connected to a local resettlement agency. How does that work?
Well, unfortunately, I don't know. I don't know how it's going to work in your friend's case because I don't know if he was given refugee status or if he was given a specific visa. There are some specific visas for people who provided services to the U.S. Armed Forces.
Yeah, the SIV.
So it's like without knowing what his specific situation is, it's kind of hard to know for me what the process he's going through. I can tell you that, you know, if he got the SIV visa, it's not easy to get. You said that, you know, you and your friends had worked on this for a while. We have a case that we've been working on for probably a year and a half, and it's it's the epitome of bureaucracy in that you just kind of
moral outrage.
Yep, reaching out and trying to do advocacy and not hearing anything back, and then all of a sudden you hear something and you're supposed to, you know, move the next day. So,
And I'm absolutely asking this for selfish reasons. The church I serve here in Austin, we have a strong ESL program, and I'm wondering, okay, how can we take this to the next level of hospitality?
And thank you, because I actually didn't get back to that. I didn't get back to the other part of your question, which is how can local UUs help? I think one of the greatest things that we can do is really work with our communities to make sure that they are welcoming communities. There are always going to be some services that are available, such as, ESL classes and things like that. But classes are not the same as, like, places to practice. So there are some places, there are some UU churches who and congregations who offer, coffee chats where they just have, you know, an open time where they invite people from the community to come in and practice chatting in English, and they provide coffee and cookies and some childcare. Childcare is a really, really important thing to consider anytime you're doing something with refugee families, because A, they very likely don't have the funds to pay for a babysitter, but it also may not be culturally something that they understand yet, that it's okay to leave their children with someone. Remember, they're fleeing a country. They're fleeing persecution. They're fleeing fear of death. They're not going to have their children out of their sight. So being able to say, great, come on, you know, this day, and we're going to have coffee and cookies and just practice English and get to know our neighbors, you know, and providing childcare activities for the kids during that time is a wonderful way to do that. Of course, being involved in your city council, being involved in your county and state politics, and making sure that the liberal religious voice is being heard, and that we are, you know, we speak about this as saying, you know, my faith teaches me to honor the inherent worth and dignity of all people. And that's, today's actually International Human Rights Day. It's the day that the International Declaration of Human Rights came out in 1948, I believe. And I love that they start with the International Declaration of Human Rights starts with the inherent dignity. It's not worth and dignity, but it is the inherent dignity of all people. And I love that. I love that connection. But we need more people upholding that. We need more people speaking out from that and kind of turning the religious conversation and partnering with our other religious partners who are speaking in favor of refugees and immigrants. The Catholics are doing a great job of that. Our Muslim brothers and sisters are doing a great job of that as well.
This might be a great time to talk about that survey that we were talking about earlier.
Oh, absolutely. Let me just pull this up so that I'm not making up numbers.
Oh, go ahead and make up numbers.
Make up numbers. Everyone likes me. Was that a good number? So there was a survey that came out this morning from the Public Religion Research Institute, and it's the Religious News Survey. So it was just released this morning. And one of the things that it said, which I thought was really interesting, is that 53% of Americans say that they are, you know, are in favor of refugee resettlement, and 41% are clearly not. But it breaks it down via religion, and it breaks it down a little bit on political leanings and education and race. When it comes to religions, probably the biggest thing that we found is that evangelical Protestants were at 43%, so less than 50% in favor. White mainline Protestants were 45%, and non-white Protestants were 47% in favor of allowing Syrian refugees, and contrasting that with the Catholics, who were 57% in favor of allowing refugees, and religiously unaffiliated Americans at 60%. And I'd like to look at that religiously unaffiliated Americans. I haven't seen their breakdown of what that means, because the way that I originally saw it was the way that it was reported in the editorial was that religiously unaffiliated and liberal religions. So that would be interesting to me to see.
Katya, I wanted to ask, so if someone, what are some of the examples of direct services you offer? If someone called you, you rise and says, you know, we need help. What are some of the things that you, what are the direct services that you offer?
Sure. So we specialize in working with marginalized immigrants, so people who we view as having the least access to quality legal services for immigration. So we do the standard family-based immigration, naturalization, helping people become U.S. citizens, and DACA, Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals. Those are, you know, kind of the big standards. But we also specialize in working with immigrant victims of crime, who may be eligible for some protections if they're assisting with the investigation and prosecution of that crime, with victims of human trafficking, special immigrant juveniles who are children who are in the United States who have been abandoned or abused or neglected, assisting them in being able to petition for themselves. Victims of domestic violence under the Violence Against Women Act, which of course protects all victims of domestic violence. And of course, as you use, we are intentionally welcoming and outreaching to the LGBTQ community and making sure that we're providing a safe space for them to be who they are and receiving their, you know, any immigration services.
How do you find them? Do they find you? How does that work? What's that process like?
We do a lot of education and outreach. So we do the direct practice legal services. We do education, outreach, community organizing as well. And so we tend to find people in the area through that, and we tend to find people outside of our area because they're looking for someone, they're looking for an agency that would be intentionally welcoming or that specializes in, you know, some of these you know, very serious, very delicate types of cases. In the education and outreach, we do a lot in Southern California, also at, you know, different district assemblies and at General Assembly every year, trying to provide as much information, not only to the people who are directly impacted, but those who are impacted by being friends, neighbors, and congregants with other immigrants. So we really try to do both parts. We try to educate and organize immigrants, but we also try to educate and organize allies who are able to help and change the conversation and move forward with that. So other direct practice that we do that's not related directly to immigrants is consulting on detention visitation programs, consulting on if your congregation was interested in becoming a sanctuary congregation, what does that mean? What are some of the legal things that you need to look at? How do you go about having that conversation as a congregation and making that determination? If your congregation can't be involved in that way, what way could they be involved? How do you be a sanctuary support congregation? Again, looking at you know, some of the things that, we've already talked about with refugees. How can you use, continue to move forward with helping immigrants and refugees and supporting them under the UU banner, showing who we are and showing that we are walking our walk. And again, so encouraging congregations to do and individuals to do what they can. And for some people, that's, again, setting up the coffee conversations. For some of them, it's just connecting them to other immigrant rights organizations who are in the areas. You know, sometimes 20% of a congregation wants to work on immigration, and sometimes there's two people in the congregation who want to work on it. So we want to, where there's just two people in a congregation, we do our best to try and connect them to other UUs in the area, or other UCCs in the area, or other liberal religions, or other organizations who are working on that, so that people don't feel alone and they actually have that value added of working with people on something larger than themselves.
Yeah, one of the a few weeks ago we had on The View, we had folks from Canada, and they were saying that more than half of the congregations, the CUC isn't huge, you know, but like over 25 congregations in Canada had sponsored or were in the process of sponsoring a family from Syria, and they talked about how, you know, other churches were, you know, had sent them a check for $1,000. We can't, you know, we can't do this, but here's money. And I thought that was just so great, because I think so often people sometimes look at this and sort of say, oh, this is, you know, it's that same feeling that people feel about institutions anyway. And people kind of go, oh, if I sign up for this, will I be getting direct email, you know, and mailings for the next 6 years? Because in some ways, you know, there's, you know, everyone wants to help out right away. Oh, right. You know, I mean, we posted the Chicago church, you know, sponsoring a family, and someone had posted that on the church's Facebook page, and people were like, how do we do this? And it's like, that's great. I want people to help, but I also don't want people to feel like, you know, because that is always the worry, that as quickly as people want to help, they will quickly forget about the folks that we've decided to help and move on to whatever else, whichever way the wind's blowing, you know, next. I mean, can you talk a little bit about the sort of the long-term support that you all and that we all can help provide to refugees?
Absolutely. You know, that's one of the things that I actually talk about a lot in UU circles, is how do we keep ourselves from trying to be the great white hope? I think that One of the things that you use do amazingly well is that we are boots on the ground. We will jump in, and someone says we need to be there, and we will be there, and we will show up. And someone says they need help, and we will jump in and do that help. What we haven't always done a good job of doing is looking to see who we're going to land on when we jump in. And so, unfortunately, all too often, we land on the immigrant-led groups who are doing the organizing, the community-based groups who've already been doing this work, and we, you know, jump in, dun-dun-dun, and here we are. And so I'm always hopeful that we can be more intentional about doing that, and part of being intentional is exactly the question that you're asking, is looking at if you're going to bring a family into sanctuary, or if you're going to look at sponsoring a refugee family, what does that mean? And the very first part of the conversation that I like to have is that this is a long-term commitment. And it's a long-term commitment generally to somebody you don't know, and you may not end up liking. And you still have to have that commitment, right? Because the commitment is to, you know, not necessarily to that specific person, but to the issue.
Just like family members, whether we like them or not.
just like family members. And it's, and I don't say that to discourage anyone from helping out, but I do say it so that, again, it's mindful and intentional when you're getting into it. When it comes to resettlement, you know, any time congregations want to do work like that, they're going to have to work with a local resettlement agency. Again, whether that's you know, Catholic Charities, International Rescue Committee, Jewish Family Service, Lutheran Services, you're going to have to work with a resettlement agency, and each resettlement agency is going to have their rules about, you know, how that works and how a congregation or an individual would sponsor a family. But the biggest thing, again, is that it's a long-term, ongoing commitment, and you want to make sure that you know all of that information before you make the decision. Because if it's not a good fit for your congregation to sponsor that, sponsor a family, then there's many steps that you can take to support a congregation or a family who is sponsoring someone. And again, that goes back to, I think, what Hank said about, you know, a congregation in Chicago. So you may not be able to do the same thing, but you may be able to support them monetarily, or you may be able to support them by inviting the family to do things with your congregation as well. So they're expanding who it is they know, and they're expanding their support system and expanding, you know, their social community.
The congregation here in Ann Arbor, which I just recently joined, started with a family from El Salvador, and is sponsoring them. I think in about 1985 or the early 80s, or when the war in El Salvador was really hot. I mean, they started out living on church property,
yeah,
as a genuine sanctuary kind of thing. And we recently, in our 150th anniversary, we were reviewing this, and this relationship with this family is literally 30 years old at this point. They're no longer supported by the church, but as the children of that family were at a celebration where they were talking about their college degrees that they had earned in here in the University of Michigan systems, you know, and at community colleges, and the jobs that they had. I think one of their children was an immigration lawyer now. So it's a incredibly long-term thing, but that was a very contentious relationship at various times. You know, as the family, you know, assimilated into the United States, and they had this relationship with these people, there was times when that relationship got very difficult for both sides, right? This kind of a long-term, and, you know, moving through dependency into independence, you know, and self, you know, without not needing help anymore. You know, I mean, it was just, it's a very complicated relationship. to get into. And the very thing that makes us good in some sense is that we are willing to put boots on the ground relatively quickly. But the reason you're able to do that is because you are not, you know, because you're not making those long-term commitments, right? So the next time, you know, I mean, it's like it's a double-edged sword, right? I mean, if we had always, you know, fulfilled everything, you know, in long-term that we should have, we wouldn't have anybody to put out in a new situation, right? So it's a very, you know, that's a church really has to kind of think through what its commitments are, which means that the people in the congregation have to think through, because it is going to be, unless you have champions in that congregation to keep, you know, keep at it, you're not going to be able to sustain that just as an institution.
And it's hard for everyone to not get caught up in the sexy topic of the time.
Oh,
right.
Yeah.
Right now, the sexy topic is refugees. 2 months ago, the sexy topic was related to DACA and DAPA, and before that, it was victims of human trafficking. And,
then the kids at the border issue. You
right,
know that.
Right. That and sanctuary has been a sexy topic in the last year as well.
Yeah.
And so people get really excited, and then they start to move forward. And I don't ever want to feel like the person going, "Whoa, whoa, whoa! Don't do that." I just want to be the person saying, "Let's take a breath together. Let's take a breath together." And you know, truly for me, whether you're getting involved with refugee families and as far as trying to resettle or with providing sanctuary, really there should be a time of discernment. There's many ways that people can get involved that don't, you know, require that type of long-term commitment. And so I'm always hopeful that people will kind of start with those things and say, yes, do we actually have the interest behind this? And what is it like to hold meetings in two different languages? Because it doubles your meeting time. So instead of having an hour-long meeting, you've now got a 2+ hour meeting because you know it's done completely in both languages, so that everyone understands.
Wait, two languages? Yeah. Oh, I take back everything I've said before. Yeah. Like, wait a minute, the meeting's gonna go twice as long. Oh.
Yeah, those are the logistics.
You might as well be Canadians.
How does Robert's Rules of Order work in Urdu? How does that
work?
If you are just now tuning into The View, we are in the second part of our show. We are talking with Katia Hansen, President and CEO of UU Rise, UU Refugee and Immigrant Services and Education. Everyone, take just a quick second to reintroduce yourself. I'm Joanna Fontaine Crawford in Austin, Texas.
And I'm Tom Shade in Ann Arbor, Michigan.
I'm Aisha Hauser in Seattle, Washington.
Hank Peirce in Milton, Massachusetts.
From Bob LaValle in Buffalo, New York. And I have a quick question. This is actually contrary to the spirit of what we just got done talking about making long-term commitments. And I want to know, what are the three best things I can do for my man from Afghanistan when he gets off the plane in February? He's going to be arriving in Buffalo in February with his wife and 5 kids who are teenagers. He's got a resettlement agency, I know, but what can I do for him? That's actually not misguided.
Oh, my goodness. This is an interesting one because this is someone you know, whereas so often it's people we don't know. So my answer for you is going to be probably a little bit different than if it was there was just a family that you'd never heard of who is being resettled. Because it's someone that you know, the most important thing is going to be, well, this is actually the most important thing either way, is asking them what it is that they need, right? The resettlement agency is going to be providing them with a certain amount of things. You know, so I'm hopeful that that means they'll have winter clothes, winter coats and boots and things like that that are size appropriate and that the kids and the family think are okay. But whether or not they've got toys, whether or not they've got books for the kids to read or books to read to the kids, whether or not they have any of their normal and familiar things, because he has family there, I'm hopeful that his family has an idea of where some of the appropriate ethnic grocery stores are. where they're going to be able to get some of the food, some of the clothing items that they would want from home. Silly things like the smell of our shampoo that we've always liked can, you know, help calm and you know, bring you back into a normal space. Because it's your friend, I think, you know, you want to kind of play it by ear with him and find out, you know, maybe in the first week he doesn't want to be invited anyplace and he just wants to settle in and see if he actually feels safe here. Or he may be really gregarious and be like, great, can you show me around the town and can we have dinner with your family and things, you know, take me ice skating, things like that. But you don't know. So anytime you're working with a refugee family, it's always going to be trying to determine what it is that they want and what they need, and then honoring and respecting that, that is legitimately what they want and need, that we don't actually know better than them. And I think if there are people who don't have connections in that area, being able to introduce them to some connections, again, ideally they're going to get that through the resettlement agency. The goal is that there's different people who are resettled in the same area. And knowing where, again, some of the ethnic, the grocery stores are, where they're going to be able to get some of the things. Because if they're just pointed to, you know, Kroger's and Ralph's and Vaughn's and Winco and
Wegmans.
Yeah, exactly. You know, it's to walk into that grocery store and be like, I don't even understand, you know, what these things are or how they are to be used.
Would it be better just to like get them a bunch of gift cards or get them money?
It's never bad for anyone to have access to some of their own funds, right? So so that's
definitely money.
Yeah, I would say that's certainly going to be a nice thing. Again, I think so often what it is people need connection. They need connection and they need to feel safe. And unfortunately, there's not a one-size-fits-all way of making that happen. So, you know, for some people, that's going to be, being invited to your home, being invited to, you know, participate in, you know, events going on at your congregation, being invited to, you know, free concerts at the library, things like that, you know, introducing them to what are activities and services available to them in the community are always going to be wonderful. It's trying to find out from them what they need that I always think is the most important thing. And what they need may not be something that you can do. And part of asking that question is having to be okay with that you're just holding space for, what do you really want? I want to go back home.
Right.
Okay.
Right. Here in Austin, First UU Church of Austin was a sanctuary church earlier this year. Do you have any feeling for how many UU churches are doing that?
Oh, goodness. You know what? I don't know. I know that there are a number who have said that they will be sanctuary churches, whether or not they're actually currently having anyone in sanctuary. I know that UU Austin was successful, UU Tucson has been successful, UU Denver has been successful, but I don't know right now, off the top of my head, I apologize, I don't know what churches currently have sanctuary. I know that there are a lot who are currently in discernment to determine whether or not they want to become a UU sanctuary church, and I believe that Reno just took a vote so that they have said that they will be a sanctuary church if needed.
And can you explain a little bit about that? Because I think that some people don't understand, you know, some people only see it as like sanctuary and protecting people and don't understand the whole what you do with the press and that you're public about this and who you contact and that this has been done as a statement.
Right. So becoming a sanctuary congregation is, like you said, very public. It's very intentional. I would say it's an act of civil disobedience. for the congregation to say, this person has, you know, an order of deportation, and we are taking them into sanctuary in our building, and keeping them protected from being deported. And it generally is when, you know, attorneys are trying to work to have a case, you know, administratively closed or reopened, or to have, you know, ICE review the current order, have the courts review the current order. But it really is taking someone in a very public way. It's not hiding someone away. It's very publicly saying, we are taking them and allowing them to stay here. In our, you know, in our church, because there is a public policy, not a law, but a public policy that says immigration law enforcement will not come into your church, into your faith community, and remove someone for deportation. There are a lot of challenges with it, though, because in essence, because this person has publicly stated, I am defying the order to leave because I think that I have a good, you know, I have a good reason to fight this, and I think that I can win. But in the meantime, I am defying this order. And so in some ways, even though they're not in a detention center, being in sanctuary is a bit similar to detention because they can't go to the grocery store. They can't go to the soccer match, you know, with their friends. They can't go to their children's school play because once they step out of the protection of the church, they are no longer protected, and they've made it known that they're out there. So again, these are some of the challenges that play into it. When the sanctuary program originally started, and the new sanctuary, you know, people were hopeful that this would be for a couple of months. You would be housing someone for a couple of months, and we're more and more seeing that it's, you know, a year that someone is living there. A year or more. How long was your person in Austin?
It wasn't a year, but it was several months.
Yeah, so. Yeah. It's a big commitment, and it's something that you know, different congregations do it differently, but there are a lot of congregations that require that there is always a volunteer there in case police or law enforcement do show up. So then you're looking at 24-hour volunteer staffing on top of the fact that the immigrant family, individual or family, is living there. You know, there are a lot of moving parts and a lot of considerations. It's an amazing act of love and act of courage, but it's not something that every congregation can do, including physically. They may not have the space for it.
Katya, Katya, were you called on for help with any of the recent sanctuary congregations?
So Dan Strack, I know, has, I know that he consulted with Reno. He's consulted with Denver. So URISE has, you know, certainly, you know, tried to help any congregations who are interested look at what it is that they need to look at. We're currently consulting with a UCC congregation here in San Diego County, you know, talking about the discernment process and what it is that they need to consider doing. They have a challenging situation that many congregations do, in that they also have a daycare center on site. And so, you know, what does that mean for licensing for daycare? If you have someone who's living there, and you know, so there's again all of these moving parts that you're trying to look at. So we have tried to be as open as possible in, you know, answering questions and helping people enter into the discernment process, and even recognizing that there really needs to be a discernment process. This is not it's not a committee that makes this decision. It really should be a congregational vote.
So what is some low-hanging fruit for churches that want to get their feet wet, not just necessarily with sanctuary, but, you know, with the whole issue of refugees and immigrants?
Well, I think the first thing is for people to find out whether it's a small group ministry, it's a social justice ministry, whether it's a few individuals, or whether it's a congregational project. I think people need to determine what it is that makes their heart sing. If it's working with refugees, fantastic. There's lots of ways to do that. If it's working with young adults who may qualify for DACA, Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, there's great ways to get involved there. If it's naturalization, a lot of people are really pushing naturalization this year because, of course, we want as many people as possible who can become U.S. citizens to do so early in the year so that they're eligible to vote and their voice is being heard in the presidential elections. So the low-hanging fruit in all of these is going to be connecting to organizations who are already doing this work. So in their area. URISE did the National Day of Service at Justice General Assembly in 2012, and part of what we did, that was when we assisted 350 people at Justice GA in Phoenix in becoming submitting their applications to become U.S. citizens. And part of what we created was a national a list of other organizations who were doing naturalization work in all 50 states. So there's easy ways to get connected to that. And if you're in an area and you don't know who the groups are, that's a great thing to contact URISE for, and we are happy to help connect you to established groups who are doing good work in that area already, so you're not reinventing the wheel and you're not jumping in with your boots on and landing on someone else.
I see we have just a few minutes left. Do we have any last minute questions by any of our panelists?
Yeah, I just wanted to get clear. URISE is like an independent nonprofit organization, like with a board, et cetera, that was founded by UUs, but is not actually a congregational project. Is that
right? We are not a congregational project, and we are not a part of the UUA. We partner with parts of the UUA, you know, quite regularly. But yes, we are an independent 501c3. A lot of the work that we've been doing lately has been partnering with the UUA's congregational advocacy and witness, and with the UU College of Social Justice and the UU Service Committee. We've been doing really good work this last year of making and standing on the side of love, making sure that the work that we're doing is supporting each other, and that we're not doubling up on things. So that's been a lot of fun.
Okay. And you have your own independent fundraising operation that...
We do. Yes, we do, and we would encourage anyone who's interested in learning more about URISE to visit our Facebook page or to visit our website, which is uurise.org. And learn more about...
We got that in there.
So next week's show is the monthly show that we have been doing, where we feature Black Lives of UU activists and leaders. We hope you can join us for that. Katia, I have a friend, David Owen O'Quill, who talks about the importance for people to find who it is that their heart breaks for. And I think you obviously have found this. So any final words, you know, on this movement that has clearly captured your heart?
I think it has captured my heart, and it's I'm incredibly lucky that I get to do work that is absolutely my passion rolling out of me all of the time. And I think one of the things that I will say quite often is, if immigration and immigrants and refugees and any of that are your passion, then please look for ways to be involved. And if you're not sure of how to do that, reach out to us, and we are happy to connect you other ways. If immigration isn't your passion, that's okay. There's still wonderful things that you can do while working on your passion, because we know that there's such intersectionality related to climate justice, related to reproductive justice, related to Black Lives Matter. All of these intersect greatly with immigration, and we know that immigrants within every one of those areas tend to be the most marginalized.
Unitarian Horace Mann said, "Be ashamed to die until you have won a victory for humanity." So, Katia, thank you very much for the victory that you are working toward, and goodbye, everyone. Thank you so much for joining us.
This has been a podcast of The View, brought to you by the Church of the Larger Fellowship. To find out more about the CLF, visit questformeaning.org.